Today is June the 21st, 2006, and we are visiting with Michael Collins. Michael is a very fine, exciting artist, contemporary artist, but I'm talking to him to tap into his memory of the memory of his father, Lowell Collins, who was such an integral part of all of the Houston art scene in the 50s and 60s. Everyone I've talked to, of course, they talk about the museum school, they talk about one thing or another, and up comes the name of Lowell Collins. So I'm going to ask Michael to go back and how did Lowell come to Houston, when did he get here, and the beginnings, and then segue into, if you remember and know, how he got into the art school and other things he did.
I hope this is audible. The earliest recollections I have of him were probably 2 years of age, slightly before then. And I'll get to that in a moment, but he was born in San Antonio, and along with my grandmother and grandfather, came to Houston as a very young boy. He got involved from my grandmother. Neither of them were artists. My grandmother, his mother, was the daughter of a builder, a person in San Antonio that built the Joe Freeman Coliseum, the dome to it, first dome in Texas. So my great-grandfather, could draw ambidextrously, start the horse's head at one side with one hand, the tail with the other, and draw it around in meat. So obviously, I think a facility was possibly a genetic. He saw his grandfather at an early age make drawings. He drew with him a lot. But my grandfather and grandmother had no ability that was visible. So when they came to San Antonio, and my great-grandfather would visit, his name was Roque George, which is my middle name, Michael Roque Collins. It was named after him. And he would say, "Lowell, come over here. Sit by me. I want to show you some things." So they would draw. And I have an ink drawing of one of his recollections of his grandfather, my great-grandfather, called it Roque. So after he showed an ability, some of the first things that I recall being told that he drew were he colored in his Grimm's Fairy Tale book, which I happen to have.
Now you're on.
After that, he had an interest in cartooning and often would cartoon regularly. And shortly thereafter, he started carving in objects when he was in middle school, let's say, when he first got his first pocket knife, my great-grandfather gave him, Roque George. So after all of this evidence, my grandmother, Faye Gorham George Collins, placed him at the Glassell School when he was very, very young. And I think that somewhere along the way, the name Leela McConnell comes into memory because I think he was a student with her somewhere. But there were many other early stories that he told me about going to Poe Middle School, Poe Elementary, and doing art classes there and having tremendous early art teachers that influenced him. Through this early period, he began to work at Glassell School, or the museum school in those days. And I remember his experiences at the time. I have evidence of a few of those early works that he did. Then the war happened, and he was, I remember him going to A&M. He was a pilot. He waited to be drafted. I actually waited for his number to be called for the cadet training. And he went to Creighton Air School. That's where he was called up for training. And as he was getting his pilot's license, or as he was getting his wings ready to serve and to be shipped overseas, probably the Pacific, he experienced labyrinthitis, which grounded him. So he spent the war in Colorado Springs. After a long stint in the hospital, it turned out that he had this inner ear problem. They think came on from a virus. But he couldn't stand up for 5 months. He was in a hospital in Amarillo where he was just busy trying to keep water down. It was very horrific. But then after this, the Air Force based him in Colorado Springs, where he was fortunate to sign up with the Colorado School of Arts and Design, where he met Otis Dozier and had some experience with Otis's friend, Thomas Art Benton. Those were his early, early experiences being trained on a collegiate sense. And I think he did this for 2.5, almost 3 years. Scholarship student. Once that was, and where he also, I believe, came into contact with Robert Prusser, who was also an early influence of him. So at some point after the war was over with, he came to Houston, but immediately went up to the Art Students League, where he met Etzel Kramer, was a fellow student. And I do know this for a fact, because one of my graduate professors at SMU in the Meadows program happened to know Harry Sternberg, because he was a printer. And Harry Sternberg ended up, I think, out in California. But he was a critical influence to both Etzel and my father. He was one of the great etchers in our country and on earth. And my father had tremendous classes and multiple years of study with Harry Sternberg. I remember a story that my father told me that one of the end things Harry said to him, he was in class and a letter came. And he opened the letter up, and sometime after Colorado Springs training, he had come back and taken more classes at the Houston Museum School of Arts, Fine Arts. And then he went up to train at the Art Students League. But within a while of study, and I'm guessing it was 2 years, I mentioned this earlier, but it could have been a little shorter time period, he gets this cable, this wire, and Harry makes him read it to the class. I can't remember if he got it or if Harry got it, but Harry was giving him trouble, and that he was offered a position to teach at the Houston Museum School. And Harry, I remember the story, really teased him about it. He said, "Lowell, pack your bags and get out of here. You're going back to Houston." And I remember he told me Etzel was laughing and ribbing him that if you have a job, you don't need to be a student. Go and teach. So when he came back, I remember this part of the story. He moved back from New York. He had been very close to my godparents, who had been Ruth Euler. Also, my godfather had been two men. One had been a professor of U of H, and one was a professor at Rice, and Dr. Chilman. And Dr. Chilman had been one of the luminaries of the Town and Gown Club, which they later called the Houston Philosophic Society, which Terrell James and I are in, and few other artists have ventured into that hallowed hall of old guard thinking. But in any event, my dad kind of became a member of that and had been a protege, a young, not assistant necessarily, but had been a friend of Dr. Chilman and Dr. Lilliard. And I remember they both saying to him, I remember this from my father's stories and their stories to me of him as a little boy, that he needed to take the lessons that he had had and needed to study with people like Robert Joy. He needed to take experiences from Prusser that he had had and Otis Dozier and Benton and turn that into a degree or two. So he went in to University of Houston, where I remember Bernie Limmel later had been a teacher of mine, which they lovingly called Hitler, who had been chairman of U of H's art department. And I say that with all loving respect for Bernie because he was a great figure teacher for me and for my father. But he went to University of Houston, where he had a tremendous portfolio already from the Colorado School of Arts and Design, from the Art Students League in New York. And somewhere in there, he had been a student at the Grand Chaumier in Paris. I think that was after he earned both of his degrees, but that can be checked in his resume. But he, because I know he spent times both in Holland and above in Norway doing ceramic scholarship, because he was also interested in ceramics, and he was also interested in and had a period of study in France, in Paris. But back to the University of Houston era, he studied there. I believe he got his undergraduate degree in short order, but they gave him, I believe, credit for work done. Then he went through the MLA program after that, because he was continuing as an instructor during that time period at the Museum School of Fine Arts. When that finished, he met actually became an instructor, an adjunct professor at University of Houston in studio art. He became an adjunct professor at Rice, teaching in architectural area, which he was teaching art for architects, basically, where people later would tell me, like Fry and some of the other architects in town who had been his students, Donald Lozier later, who had been a student of some of his mentors, like Dr. Chilman. told me stories that he had taught architecture there, failing notable art students and artists in our city of Houston. We won't go into that, but there is a hallowed history of very luminous painters, abstract painters, not doing so well in architecture. But he was a very fine teacher from my recollections of that period. And I guess after the University of Houston MLA was completed, he started then seriously as an instructor at the museum school, and at some point for an 11-year period was named dean under Sweeney's regime at the Houston Museum of Fine Arts. And I believe that's when he stopped his adjuncting at Rice and the University of Houston and focused his energies at the Houston Museum School. That is the period where I remember he met my mother as a student, as he was a teacher at the Houston University of Houston. She was a student there studying art, had studied in Tyler. And there's kind of an interesting circle here. She had been a high school friend of John Barry, who had been one of those early students of my father when I was a child.
The doctor.
Dr. John Barry. And he had been a student with several other people that had become notable Houston painters in that time period. But I remember as a young child, when after my father and my mother had married, had me, back in 1956, I was probably one. I had early memories of John coming to live with us for a summer because my grandmother on my mother's side was an art instructor as well and had taught John in Tyler, tutored him, and sent him down to work with my father after my father and mother had been married. My mother was Glenda Gale Pritchett, or Smith, and had married Lowell D. Collins. And I remember those times when he came to live with us for summer, John Barry. Later he became a neurosurgeon. But that was the first of many students my father had. I remember other people that came to him, both at Glassell and also later in 1966 when he retired as dean and started what we later co-directed as a Lowell Collins School of Art in Houston. He had people, such notables as Dan Mitchell Allison. He taught John Sturtevant. There were more than one could actually recall at any given point, but I remember he was one of the first teachers for Stephanie Caldas, and also a young man who later sculpted and ended up designing the and a student of Richard Stout's as well. He ended up being the main artist for Blade Runner, and I'll remember his name in a moment. Hayden Larson, who had been the designer of the art in Blade Runner, and my father had been his first teacher. So there was a group of these artists that came through in the Houston community that had been his, Dick Ray had been his student in architecture. There had been a numerous grouping of them, both at University of Houston, and my memories of them weren't there. They were with them at Glassell, or at the Houston Museum School.
Did he ever talk to you about his memories of the museum itself during those days, as well as what Houston was like for him as an artist? I mean, what was going on in the 50s and 60s?
Yes, absolutely, Sally. the first recollections I have, other than the smell of jade dust, which is a form of metamorphic asbestos, which I'm sure poisoned all of us, the smell of the waxes in our studio and the carving of those small miniature stone figures that he was so interested in. But I remember posters of shows at Cushman Gallery, Meredith Long, that was probably before I was born, but also later at the Gallery on Kirby that everyone had shown at,
DuBose
Gallery, were some of the last memories of his art exhibiting that I remember. But as a child, I remember people coming into our studio, guests of the museum school, people like Lee Bontecue, and staying with us to watch her fiddle as a child, the compulsive nature that she had making little things like Lipsky would make decades later really hangs in my mind. Like little, I remember her comment, and I even took it in my memory, her comments about bits of pigment being like pebbles on a road, being like jewels. Really stayed in my mind. And my father had a non-stop grouping of friends that he had, which were people like Jack Boynton, people like photographers, Hack Miller, who had been best friends of his at a very early photographing the arts of Houston, my father at his jade carving tools in the 50s prior to my birth, trips that they would take to Mexico together, which only one's wildest imagination of young hedonism could imagine what both of them actually got, how they got into trouble. I'm just glad they actually made it back out of... Yes, so I could be here and a proud descendant of him and student of his teachings. But I remember Charles Shorey coming in and John Biggers. I remember John Biggers and Shorey saying that if your father's station wagon had died, that the art movement wouldn't have made it in Houston. It was a quote from both John and Charles Shorey. And that they wouldn't have been able to move their art anywhere because they all used my dad's station wagon. And I think Jack Boynton was probably in that group of artists who needed the wagon to get the art from point A to point B. So other than my house being on Drexel, which was designed by Harwood Taylor, who later Kiko Asawaka, who had Kiko Gallery, had married, and he had designed so many interesting places in Houston. That began to be a kind of a little central hub of early discussion about art and about humanist aspects. Maybe that was pre-Lucas Johnson and pre that advent of James Searles and John Alexander and the whole, quote, Houston School.
That would have been more probably mid-50s.
50s, as at my birth. I think so.
Did he ever relate any funny stories to you that stick out in your mind about something funny that tickled him at the museum?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I remember his stories about the University of Houston and all the frontier days that they would, the art department would have, and all the wild parties that he would do backdrops for, and his students would do backdrops for, and all the incredibly bizarre galas and costume events that they all must have done, and the early Prince's Hamburger places that they would all take dates to, and the sheer insanity that he and Hack Miller were involved, the merriment of that era of the innocence and naivete of the 50s and the sock hops and all that he was involved with. I remember parties that he and my mother would go to that were just tremendous costumes, and those things kind of stay in my mind. But more of the get-togethers with Biggers, their early interest in primitive art and trading, swapping art back and forth, both African art and their works back and forth. With Paul Maxwell, I have an example of his work that was traded, obviously, to my father during that time period. Probably not perhaps much more than it was then, and I remember my father and others that worked there at the time were saying, you know, we should look at Cranbrook and take a model for accreditation and expand and become more of a serious school and that's accredited. So I remember my father's battles that he fought for accreditation and for it to be taken seriously and for them to have a tremendous training system there. And the people that my father amassed, like David Parsons and Richard Stout, who he gave his first job to, and William Anzalone, and the whole litany of what later became the Rice and U of H backbone of their faculties all came out of his early mentorship and his deanship, where he tried to build the Houston Museum School to be formidable.
You mentioned John Biggers and some others and his interest in the primitive and in African art and other art, and I know as time went by, I remember your father dealing in primitive art and appraising primitive art and having a love of that work. Did that come, do you think he always had that, or did that sort of grow the more he was around John Biggers and others in our community? How do you think that flowered?
As I was, a great question, as I was studying his early sketchbooks, which I happen to have all of from that museum period, the U of H study period, Colorado Springs, and then into his early period of teaching at the museum school, I started to see this love of the comic be transferred over into pre-Columbian art. Mm-hmm. And I found early references of Colima vessels, gourd vessels. So oddly enough, like the way, perhaps differently, but on a parallel reference of influence that maybe some of the British sculptors that we would see, Henry Moore, mm-hmm. his influence of that negative, that absence of form within a structure, the negative space. He had this interest in the curve and the gourd-like vessel shape and those things that he was starting to see in pre-Columbian Kalima cultures in Nairit. And right about that same time, I started seeing Yoruba figures and some of the early drawings that he did of some Congo form. So, and they looked comic. And some of his early figures had that primitive dial of visual reference, sentiment, if you will. And I can't help but think that early discussions that Sarah Trotty relayed to me about what he and John were having at the time, Dr. Biggers and he were having, because my father won the numerous local area artist exhibit the Houston Museum would have, and I remember one of my first early recollections of him having a solo there. Well, other artists like John Biggers, who also won the area artist exhibit, were not enabled to go in the front of the show and weren't able to attend their own award ceremony. They had to go with their own African-American group through the back door, which I remember my father threw a huge fit. And Sarah later reminded me of that story, that it was my father who stood up and said, well, we weren't going to have that here. If I'm going to be the dean of this school and we're going to be here teaching, all people will be equal and there won't be any favoritism and there won't be any kind of prejudice whatsoever towards women or of African American. That's one of the things, Sally, that colors a lot of my memories of childhood, because he had John Biggers over all the time. They were very dear friends. And on a film that my father made in memory, that my wife made about my father in his memory, she has quotes from early people that trained with him, like John Barry, and also Sally. There were several other people that that were Sarah Trotty that knew of Biggers and my father's friendship. So that may be of interest to this, and I'll try to find a copy for you.
Sure.
But I remember that, and I remember my father also being really upset by that segregation, and he was always interested in primitive art. And I think what he didn't like was the, quote, kind of not business end of art, but he got to the point where he was tired of all of that gallery business. I think he really wanted to just make his art and not really be involved commercially with it, with the selling of it.
Well, is that how it came about then that he ended up having his own gallery together? That he decided to pull away from some of the other retail places and to set his own tone, so to speak.
I have memory of him showing in New York at the World's Fair in 1964. I think he had a group show at Nodler. I can't tell you the date, but I remember him telling me about his experience commercially in New York and also representing Texas with one other artist in the World's Pavilion, the Texas Pavilion in the World's Fair in 64. I even went to see it with my grandparents. And shortly after that time period in 64, I remember he started thinking about having his own school, and then by night, which he started in 66 when he retired from the museum school. But I remember, you know, during his second marriage, he started making less and less art and really doing more and more appraising, and selling of pre-Columbian became a love of his. But all the while, he'd make watercolors on the side and continuing his jade carving, because he said, I really want to make art just for me. And he said, so many of my friends have ended up making art for themselves, but at the end of the day, they have to argue with dealers, and they have to, you know, have art be seen and shown, and there's a big, you know, he said, a big industry in that. And he said, I'd rather let you do that, son, later, and just show my work, you know, later down the line. So I think, in a real way, he got more interested in appraising and pre-Columbian and African art and Chinese art and the love of pure art than he was holding a primary interest in showing his own art that he had made for 30 years straight and then began to make less of when these other archaeological interests started to become more in the forefront of his daily activities. He always warned me, though. He said, I think becoming a dean of the Glassell Museum of Fine Arts Art School was the beginning of my more shift towards an interest in the history of art. And he said, I think it kind of cut out my own passions for making art because you were so busy administrating that day work, the teaching work of all the other artists you had hired. So I remember Weimerskirch working with him, and I remember so many other people that he had been involved with almost as underlings or students of his during that early period, pre his dean run as being dean, that he, I remember he said one warning to me. He said, you will continue to paint, but never be a dean.
Well, did he ever share with you as you were growing up sort of his sense of, and you were there part of the 60s as a child, but of what Houston was like to live here? I mean, other people have described it certain ways. I mean, did he ever share, do you have any sense of his sense of that time?
I remember in a way that he was just absolutely horrified at what, as he witnessed from childhood on, with this whole segregation, with the whole problem of African Americans not being equal in so many ways. And that was always, again, part of something that I couldn't, well, I was always raised in an accepting environment. So for me to see it at school and the N-word and all of the other things that were used in culture so openly was just horrific. I've yet to deal with that in my own art and maybe thoroughly, but I'm sure it's something that's going to pop up later in relation to aspects of being human. But he did, I remember our home being kind of a bubble, and I remember in that early 60s his disbelief, but his feeling of excitement that Houston had so many different influences here. Later, things that I heard Lucas and other people talk about, Lucas Johnson, I heard my father echo decades prior to that, in that he loved the water. He took me to the coast every other weekend. We had a little boat. We'd go out fishing. He loved to see light on the water. I mean, he loved fishing. He loved being, I love the smell of shrimp remind me of him, his early encaustic paintings. I remember his love of the coast, and I remember, his conversations with other artists that would be immediately, like Ian Bakshiwitz, that had been friends of his, and he had hired, actually, to teach a materials and methods course at the museum school. I remember those people being in our house talking about shrimp and the smell of beer with the shrimp and the crab meat and etouffee. And I remember early trips he took me to New Orleans, and our first raw oyster I ever consumed with horseradish was probably to my later, gastrointestinal detriment, was consumed with him there, and his love of the South, but not the South that would later color and characterize hate, but a kind of an exuberant, fishy resonance of hope and light and kind of inclusion that our house was remembered for, that Sarah Trotty will tell you about, and what got my father into such trouble with the right-wing establishment of the cowboy gentry of the city so many ways. He was always an outsider, and in some ways proud to it to the end of his life.
Was this outsider mantle put on him because of his socializing with all kinds of different people from all walks of life, including those of color? That was the real reason?
Uh-huh. I think so.
Yeah. How did he become friends with... Ruth Euler would have been several years older than your father. Did she teach your father?
Or?
That you think that's how it came about? Because,
I think so.
Yeah.
Her relationship as an artist with one of the very early women who we had spoken of earlier, that I never had the... If I met her, she probably passed away with Grace Spaulding Johns.
She, I think, passed away before you were born.
Probably. I just remember so many conversations my dad had about, and then Ruth Euler being such a... So I think she could have been a teacher of my father, because he was, again, a student at the Houston Museum School, and it was in the back behind that beautiful classical facade that was in the back of the museum. So I just have remembrances of those Houston area artist exhibits and the solo exhibits that artists who won that were given. It was just amazing. Jack Boynton, my father, John Biggers. There was a whole litany that characterizes the first remembrances of that facade that was being put on and the guest artist that came to the museum school.
Do you ever remember your father talking about Jack Flanagan?
Oh.
You want to tell us a little bit about Jack?
Oh, boy.
Jack Flanagan was probably the person that introduced my dad, other than my godfather, Dr. Chilman and Dr. Lilliard, to... Charles Barrington, who later became a silent partner with my dad in a company that collected Mesoamerican artifacts. In the true passion that Carborubius had about Mesoamerican artifacts, my father and John Farrington were friends with Jack Flanagan. Now, Jack Flanagan and Gene Bilfalt tried forever to get me to become, and also my dear interviewer, Sally, to become a business associates and trainees of theirs and their wonderful conservation business. And to my knowledge, a little aside story, I was in Guatemala with one of my friends, Rick Barron, when we were at Rice and U of H, respectively. And we were down, this was in the mid-70s, we bumped into a young couple, a young man and his wife from Spain that was there to conserve the paintings that had been damaged and frescoes from the earthquake that had occurred. And we started talking in my broken Espanol about who I had known in Houston, who was also a conservator, Jack Flanagan and Gene Bilfalt. And they laughed and said they were my teachers. They were one of the great eight couple conservators on earth. And I hadn't realized Jack's preeminence and Gene's preeminence in this area of restoration. But so I was all the way in another part of Mesoamerica before I knew exactly what he was like. But yes, as a child, I remember when my father was starting to repair the artifacts that they would bring back that had been broken, clay artifacts that Jack and Gene gave them, which I still have in a bucket out here, this carborundum, this wonderful conservator's wax that they would use to infill before they would paint over. And it has this incredible aroma that is equally distinct in my memory as the smell of the jade being carved with an electric high-speed bit, which again is really amazing aroma. Quite toxic, but amazing nonetheless. And I remember that Jack Flanagan having us to his studio, and I remember seeing these Monets and these wonderful paintings. My dad would take me over there. So Gene was the great infiller, and where Jack's vision had gotten a little bad, and they always kept referring that I should go to Winitor. Alas, as a reformed dyslexic, my math was so weak I probably wouldn't have made such a good science student in chemistry. So I never really opted for that track. But yet, to this day, I love infilling, and whenever a painting is damaged at my father's, which one was in our recent move out of our old studios on Saint, I have the joy now of being able to infill this and match the color exactly due to what Jack told me to do as a student. He said, you know, Jack said to me something that my dad so often repeated. He said, you know, and I'm sure later in my continuing studies that this came from Matisse's comment about returning to nature as a young artist, having our own way yet to make. He said, the only way young artists really get to understand color is to look at nature and copy her. He said that if we can't, by means of our own way, mimic that urgency and rhythm of nature, then how will our own soul, which is deeply buried within the bone of our being, how will that ever come through in the arteries of our later interests and capability to be expressed as art? And he said, so that to be able to infill a Rembrandt or a Monet takes that facility that comes only from observing nature, our human form, our color that is in nature first, and then color later could be expressed. But he was, I mean, when you said that, I hadn't really consciously, I was thinking more of my dad, but I think so much of my dad's early teachings were commingled with that of Jack and Gene and what they had discovered as artists and conservators. They were great artists in that period. This is another story about Jack Flanagan and Gene Vilfong. I remember one day after I had gotten out of school, University of Houston, and I had always done watercolor as an undergraduate and large pencil drawings, and my father said, okay, you show signs of disturbed interest in your self-expression, and you're doing those dreams, there you go again. Well, you're going to have to go talk to Jack and Gene because I want him to show you the right way to stretch a linen. So Jack and Gene, I showed them what I had read out of the materials and methods book that my father had recommended, and Jack and Gene immediately said, yes, that's a great book. You know, Mayer's wonderful. Read it all and memorize it. Make it to heart. Learn how to grind your own pigments. So they went through all of this with me. And then they said, okay, we're going to talk to you about rabbit skin glue and oil-based primer, and you must do it this way. And they proceeded to show me. They stopped all of their restoration on that Rembrandt and on all of these wonderful artifacts, and they said, okay, here's how you're going to do it. He showed me everything. And I had stretched from my father years ago for all the art students that had been followed him from Glassell to our art school. So I had stretched for my summer job for $1 a stretcher, about 1,000 stretchers each summer. It was marvelous. Early, I can still, my fingers ache.
It did.
But I'd always stretched pre-sized and primed canvas. And so when I started doing my own really larger than the average 50 by 60, I think that was the largest I had done for students, I was wanting to stretch 78 by 110, and I needed to get, so he said, go to Jack and Gene, they're going to tell you how to do this. And so my first show that I had at Hooks Epstein, showing the larger material, larger oils, after those, all the watercolors, that was really due to Jack and Gene Jack Flanagan and Gene Bilfalt's tutelage as to how to really do this right. So they were very loving, incredibly sensitive, and giving couple.
Shy,
reclusive. I can see Jean kind of, but she had that smile, had that grin, and those glasses, I remember, that she'd smile through, her cheeks would wrinkle up, and I have such really warm remembrances, even as a child, of them being together. And so I have kind of this childhood memory with Jack Boynton and Biggers and, you know, Hack Miller and all of that period, and then I have later memories after undergrad school in the early 70s, mid-70s to late 70s, once Jack and Gene moved over off of Timmins to one of their last studios before they moved to Carolina. And then my memories of them cease at that point because I only got letters from them. But they were wonderful. Well, we've spoken just a little bit about Dr. John Barry and Sturtevant and all of the artists that my father had taught, and there are many, many more that I really don't even have recollection of. When he passed away, I'll go there first and then go back to my recollection of his teaching and the art school that he formed in 1966. But when he passed away, my wife Gail Collins, who he loved dearly, gave a life celebration for him in the gallery. We had 600 people show up that day.